بسم اللہ الرحمن الرحیم سبحان اللہ و بحمدہ سبحان اللہ العظیم All praise is due to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Lord of the worlds. Peace and salutation upon our beloved master and leader Nabi Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the medical program on Radio Islam International on this Wednesday, the 25th of May 2022. My name is Muhammad Ismail. I will be your host, and it is really a great pleasure for me to be in your company this evening, and I thank you for welcoming us into your home. So it's just gone 11 minutes past 8 Central African time on this Wednesday evening, and that means that it's time for our medical program. The medical program is brought to you by the Islamic Medical Association of South Africa. And the Islamic Medical Association is a gathering of Muslim medical professionals. And our aim is to bring medical care to the people, medical information and awareness, and to create awareness for different medical conditions, that information that probably is not freely available out there. So that's from the Islamic Medical Association. And the Islamic Medical Association is also involved in many other projects. They have a dialysis project. They have a cataract project. So if you are generous and willing to contribute, we would definitely welcome your donations. You can find the Islamic Medical Association on Google, or you can get into contact with the Radio Islam, and inshallah we will definitely appreciate your contributions. So it's our medical program on this, the 25th of May 2022. Tomorrow, the 26th of May 2022, is World Bipolar Awareness Day. So that's why it is fitting that we are going to be discussing bipolar mood disorder this evening. Now, bipolar mood disorder is in the branch of mental health, but it's one of those conditions that, in my opinion, is often overlooked. It's probably not given as much importance as the other mental health issues. Probably, in my opinion, I think it's overlooked because the way it says bipolar, people assume it to be someone who's having mood swings or something. So we're here to create awareness about this, and it's definitely a condition that needs to be taken seriously. It's probably one of those conditions that when someone is experiencing it or going through it, they themselves don't know that they are experiencing it. The people around them may mistake it for other things such as anger or depression. And that's why we've got a specialist psychiatrist here with us this evening who will be discussing bipolar mood disorder. And if you have any questions, you have any questions for our specialist, you're welcome to forward the questions on 011-854-1548. That's 011-854-1548. So we've got a specialist psychiatrist with us today. We have Dr. Ismail Mulla, who is a psychiatrist with over 35 years of experience in the field. Dr. Mulla has worked in Canada, he's worked in UK, and he's definitely going to be bringing a wealth of experience for us to create awareness for the condition, and also that we may benefit from it. And inshallah, if you have any questions, you have any information that you require, you're welcome to contact the station, and inshallah we will definitely pose your questions for our specialist. Dr. Ismail Mulla, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to Radio Islam International.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and it's a pleasure being with you this evening.
Jazakallah, Dr. Saab. We thank you for joining us. We really appreciate the time that you have given us, and we definitely make dua, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala reward you abundantly for this.
Inshallah, ameen.
Doctor, tonight, inshallah, we will be discussing bipolar mood disorder. But before we get directly into the topic, I just want you to ask you a little bit. Psychiatry is a field of medicine that's definitely not for everyone, and I feel that maybe you need to have a passion or a calling for it. What is it about psychiatry that stoked your passion or drove you towards becoming a psychiatrist?
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. You know, it's all quite often sort of cynically it is said that, you know, people get into psychiatry maybe themselves are a little crazy. And the answer may be partially true as well. But I think what you call, you know, it's a field that has been neglected a great deal. And, you know, when I started psychiatry, as you already alluded to, over 35 years ago, I mean, there were not one, let's say, psychiatrist around, let's call it Muslim, we call it Indian at the racial time, etc. But even then, among the whites, there were too few. And mental health was not even recognized and talked about. Yet, so there were lots of people at that time who were having difficulties and were not diagnosed and therefore not treated. And I encountered personally what you call in my medical school year, a friend who was in high school with me was using drugs. And he was a brilliant student and he just went down the drain, literally. I mean, his whole life fell apart completely. And that was from drugs. And I just felt helpless because my friends used to say, come on, help him because you're doing medicine. I said, you know, I'm still a student. I know nothing about these things. So, you know, it's subsequently even specializing in mental health is a branch of medicine. So like a surgeon spending years doing operations, etc., the anesthetist is spending years doping people. So in mental health, I mean, you have exposure to dealing with this branch of medicine. And yes, we were over the years and still up to now as well, we're the stepchild of medicine in a way. And our motto is that there should be no physical health without mental health. That mental health is very, very important. And every now and then one gets kind of, even sort of today, let's say some, what you call famous or, you know, individuals well known and having a mental issue and they come out to the fore. And people say, well, you know, he's come out. So what about the rest? Because these conditions are fairly, fairly common. The incidence of mental health disorders throughout the world is about 1%. So you work out the figures then, South Africa with a population of 60-odd million, 1%, that's a large number, and they're not getting treatment. And as you may well be aware, that the Esedimeni problems came to the fore to sort of illustrating how mental health has been neglected in this country, especially, again, I suppose, from the state sector, because, again, most people, it's only 8 to 10% of the population that can afford private health care. So your 80%, 90% of people need and depend on the state services. And unfortunately, those individuals and those passed away, sadly, they were neglected. And the findings of the commissions, etc., showed all of that. So I'm hoping, and Jazakallah, two programs like this, highlighting mental health and making people aware so that there is no need to hide behind, or the stigma is still there, unfortunately. But these people have to come out and say, listen, I've got this problem. And before you verbalize it, somebody else says, yeah, I also got it. I also went and saw so-and-so. And it then sort of normalizes to say, listen, how well do people say, well, I'm diabetic, or I've got high blood pressure, or I've had a bypass operation. So I've had this kind of illness and I'm under treatment. I'm much better now. So one hopes that, you know, with programs like this, we start destigmatizing mental health and saying, listen, it's common and it can affect anybody. And I mean anybody. Nobody can say they are immune and it's not going to happen to them.
Definitely, Doctor. I think that was a very, very well descriptive and a very, very appropriate, a very, very reflective statement on mental health. Definitely, it's been an important branch of medicine that has been neglected in the past. And this is why we want to bring these issues to the fore, because someone needs to understand that a mental issue is still a medical issue, and you don't need to hide away. You don't need to seclude yourself anymore. There is treatment available, and there is something that can be done to improve your quality of life. Dr. Mulla, one more thing. You have many, many years of experience in mental health. What I want to find out is mental health can be quite vast. What are your areas of interest or speciality that you focus on?
My special area has been children, adolescents, okay? And that's what I sort of, let's call it, super specialized in. meaning I've done extra and additional work with children. And the reality is that many mental health conditions start in childhood. And unfortunately, it is often in some individuals a lifelong problem. So, you know, it is that, therefore, then, you know, when you look at children, they don't live on their own. They live in a context of a family. And therefore, often one parent has a problem, mental health problem, because some of these conditions do have, and as we'll discuss with bipolar, a genetic basis that it does run in families. It does run in families. I'll ring you just now. Off.
All right. So, Doctor, I'm glad that we've got you here tonight, because if we talk about mental health being neglected, I think the branch of mental health that is even more neglected is mental health in children. Yes. Because most of the time we find that when we picture someone who's got bipolar or someone who's suffering mentally, we picture maybe a grumpy old man or a grumpy old lady. But it's definitely true that mental health does affect our children. And we need to identify these, and we need to then sort treatment for them so that we can, you know, address the issues earlier before it becomes worse. Doctor, we're going to go into a little bit of bipolar disorder now. I just want you to explain to us a little bit, what is bipolar mood disorder?
The word bipolar means, let's call it a newer terminology. The old terminology that many people may be familiar with or heard about, which is a little bit more, let's say, descriptive in terms of the illness, is manic depressive illness. Therefore, there's, and as we'll discuss just now, there's mania, a manic episode, depressive episode. But now taking that terminology change to bipolar, which means there's two poles. So again, there's an up pole, which is your mania, and there's a down pole, which is the depression. So you've got a high pole and a low pole, and that's what makes it bipolar. You contrast that with unipolar, and that means one pole, and that's invariably, it's a depressive episode only. So there are people who get depressed. They get depressed again and again. But in bipolar, there'll be times where they will get into a high mood state, and at times they will get into a low mood state. And that's what makes it. So it's a cyclical disorder. So it goes up and down. And unfortunately, it is recurrent. Means you may have just one episode, but it doesn't mean it won't come back. So you'll have another episode and another episode. So it's an episodic condition as well. It comes and goes. So you have in between periods of, let's call it, stability.
Okay. And when we talk about bipolar mood disorder, how does one develop bipolar mood disorder? What's the onset like?
You know, it's generally, it starts off in, let's call it, high school and university. So it's a young person's illness, okay? Though under the age of 18, it can occur, but relatively rare because it gets compounded with other conditions, and we'll talk about that, what we call comorbidities. Means some other condition is also occurring there, or it's copying and mimicking it, so is it really that? But it's relatively rare, or it does occur. If it does occur, let's say, for somebody at the age of 50, 55, if you go into the history, it did occur long before as well. Or it is due to, let's say, a medical condition, because there are some medical conditions and drug-related conditions as well, drug-induced conditions, or what we call substance abuse conditions, which bring on this condition as well. But clearly what has been shown is that it is a genetic disorder. It's a brain disorder where there are chemical imbalances, and we'll discuss that a little bit, but it does run in families. And if you look at just the genetic part only, in a general population, unrelated people, it affects up to 1%. Let's say 0.6 to 1%. So on, let's say, it to be a little excessive, we'll say 1 in 100 people. So anywhere in the world, So if you look at a university class, a medical school class, for instance, if there's 300 young people there doing medicine, at least three are going to get that condition. And I'm saying medical students because they are doctors with this condition, because it can affect anybody. And for some unknown reason, it tends to affect, let's call it, relatively high-performing, intelligent individuals as well. But the genetic basis in terms of the chemical disorder is well known. So from the 1% of general population unrelated, you've got a family history, it goes up to 10%. So you become 10 times more likely to develop the condition, which is quite high. So, you know, if I look at my own practice, if I treated a man 30 years ago, unfortunately, one of his children are my patients today.
That is very interesting to think about it, that it's something that not only do we have to take care of ourselves as patients, but also it can be something that we need to be made aware of in our children as well. How does one identify this condition? Would it have to be a father that knows that he has bipolar disorder, who would then identify it in one of his children? What about maybe a mother who isn't aware that she has it, but a child that then exhibits symptoms? So how would one identify the condition in a family member, and how do we approach the situation?
Well, the thing is, first and foremost, I mean, let's say your adult or your parent that you're talking about who has the illness, I mean, that clear-cut diagnostically be there, they were treated, etc. It doesn't mean all your children will get it. Maybe none of your children will get it. It's just a question of being a little bit more vigilant and observing, especially when they reach high school and university, because it can present sometimes at that age very suddenly, sudden drop in performance and behavior. We'll talk about the symptoms just now. Sometimes it can be very, very gradual. And a parent may say, my child is naughty, my child is disobedient, etc. And before you know it, they've complicated the picture by taking drugs as well to try and deal with some of the symptoms. But I think the question of, you know, the patient, maybe the sufferer, recognizing that they have this condition. And unfortunately, the initial part with many people is the denial. There's nothing wrong with me, okay? And that becomes very, very difficult, that you need to work hard with them in different kind of therapeutic modalities to get them to accept the condition, to accept that this is what is there, and that there are periods when you are going to have problems. So for you to recognize it, listen, I'm going downhill. Okay, and get help immediately because you are now, let's say, relapsing or you're having a recurrent episode.
Okay, so I agree with it. I agree that it can be quite difficult to get patients to accept the condition because I'm sure in most cases, most people must be feeling that I just have mood swings, or parents or someone might think to say, no, the child is maybe extra sensitive or may suffer from mood swings. Where does the differentiation come in between actually being bipolar or just suffering from mood swings?
Well, it is a mood disorder, okay, that you get unusual shifts in the moods. So it's not your, what we may call, let's say, a normal fluctuation. You know, one day we're feeling a bit happy, one day you're feeling a bit low, but it doesn't have any other clinical manifestation, because in this mood swings or unusual shifts in the mood, you have changes in activity levels, changes in your energy level, and then also you have changes in carrying out day-to-day functions. Now, you know, when we talk about the two phases, okay, and if you want, I may want to just go into the phases to explain, you know, the one part is a mood disturbance, the energy disturbance, the activity level disturbance. So if I just, you know, sort of let's look at this disorder, we kind of categorize it into sort of, let's say, three forms. The most severe form is your classic, what we call bipolar 1, manic depressive illness, where you've got clear-cut manic episodes, which I'll go into just now, and a clear-cut depressive episode. Then a milder form, where it's you don't have the manic episode, what you call a hypomanic, means it's less severe, and that's what we call a bipolar disorder. We call that a bipolar 2 disorder. And then at a less severe, less intense level of pathology, we have what you call cyclothymic disorder. So there was cyclical, thymic mood swing, but it's not, you don't have the extremes. So let's look at sort of the extreme. The extreme, let's say a manic episode, usually patients do not come to us at that time unless their behavior get them into problems. So they are sort of feeling high, they're feeling not just good and happy. They are ecstatic, you know. They're so happy. It's so nice to see them at that time because that happiness is very contagious. They make you laugh. I mean, you really laugh with them. And then their thoughts go so rapidly that they are joking with you all the time and you can't keep up with them because their thoughts are rapid. They go from one activity to one thought process, one activity to another. And they're kind of restless, they're jumpy, they're full of energy, and there's a decreased need for sleep. I mean, they sleep very little. They can sleep for 2-3 hours only, and they're on the go all the time. So you can imagine how exhausting it can become. They're definitely more active than usual. And lots of people will say, they say, what's happening? Why is this person, as a word you use, hyper? You know, he's really hyper now. And with that activity level, you got those, the thinking and the talking is so rapid and fast. And in between, they become irritable. They become quite sort of touchy. And there's part now, when you challenge them, they become aggressive as well. So one has to be very, very careful handling them in that state. And in that high state, they take lots of risks as well. Quite often in women, they will go on a spending spree. 3-4 hours, they will spend thousands of rand on a credit card. Okay. Some, unfortunately, get into sort of precocious sexual activities as well. Or some will sort of attend. One patient I had attended an auction, and he bid the... and unfortunately, he issued, at that time, he issued a check. And the check bounced, and the police arrested him because the auctioneer was quite upset that this check didn't go through. And that's sometimes that come into, you know, clinical attention in that kind of behavior. Now, that is your sort of manic episode. And these individuals that will come to treatment just now require urgent help because they are a danger to themselves and others in their behavior. Now, when you look at the depressive episode, it's the exact opposite. That instead of being happy and elated and full of life, they are down, they're crying, they're feeling empty, they're feeling hopeless, they have no energy to do anything. Quite often they are sleeping most of the time as opposed to the one who is active. These individuals just sleep all the time and still feel tired. They look worried. Their life is, as they described it, as empty. They cannot concentrate, or what we call they have cognitive disturbance, means their attention, their concentration, their memory is severely affected. And unfortunately, at that time, feeling low and down, they have thoughts of harming themselves. And many individuals in this state do kill themselves. So it's a serious synthesis condition with high, what we call morbidity, but also means problems occurring as a result of it for the individual, but it also has a mortality that individuals have killed themselves in this condition. So that is your what we will call your classic bipolar 1, manic depressive mania, manic episode, depressive episode. Your bipolar 2 is just a little milder. The symptomatology, and sometimes we use rating scales to kind of give a score that, you know, where is this person, but more often in a clinical diagnosis by just talking to the individuals, observing the individuals, their behavior, their activity level, we know this is a manic episode, this is a severe depressed episode, because the intensity is crucial, because it's going to your management comes into fore. The bipolar 2 and the psychotherapy disorder being a little milder, but sometimes, you know, those same individuals who have a milder form, the next time they have a full-blown manic episode.
Thank you very much, Doctor. That was a great explanation. I think definitely you've highlighted the severity of the condition, and it definitely should not be taken lightly or ignored. We're just going to go for a short break, inshallah. When we come back, we're going to be discussing the signs to look out for, how we're going to diagnose the condition, and also treatment, inshallah. So we'll just take a short break, and we will be back with you shortly. Welcome back to Radio Islam International. It is the medical program. And this evening, inshallah, we are discussing bipolar mood disorder. We have a specialist psychiatrist, Dr. Ismail Mullah, who's joining us to provide us with some specialist input and information. And you're welcome to forward your questions to us. You can call the studio on 011-854-1548. Dr. Ismail, we were speaking before the break about the types of bipolar and the way they manifest clinically in patients. If we can look at a little bit of signs and symptoms that maybe a patient or families of a patient can look out for, and from this step forward, how would the condition be diagnosed?
First and foremost, you know, depends on the patient in what phase they are in. Okay, you know, usually they come to us not when they are manic or even hypomanic, unless they behave, like I said, caught them and get them into trouble in a way, or they're quite disturbing to family and neighbors, etc. But more often than not, it's a depressive episode when they're low, down, etc. Everybody notices that he's gone or she's gone very quiet, she's not talking very much, she's sleeping all the time, eating very little or eating too much. So, you know, we interview the individual with the family, because quite often they would not come for assistance voluntarily. And that, you know, creates a problem in terms of management and treatment as well, because, you know, one treats individuals voluntarily, I mean they agree to come for treatment. If they do not agree, then mental health legislation has to come in, and involuntary treatment is, again, something, you know, you don't want anyone to go through, but sometimes we're forced to use the courts to incarcerate such individuals, and that does not happen very rarely in private. It's more often in the government hospitals, and that again has its own repercussions for the individual. So we interview generally the individual with the carer, whoever the carer is, a family member, maybe a spouse, maybe a pair of parents, and they give you kind of information of some of the behavioral changes, etc. And then when you interview the individual alone, you sort of observing their thought processes, which is sometimes, which is more the one clue that's going to get you in, is, are they talking so rapidly? Then when they talk rapidly, they're going from one thought to another. They don't finish, they don't complete their thoughts. They start rhyming and they start singing and then start joking with you. So you straight away realize that this person is high now. This is from a clinical side. Obviously, from the depressive side, again, they're very quiet, not saying very much, or get one word answers from them. And then the sleep has been affected, the appetite has been affected, the activity, and then often depending on in the school and university environment, there with the cognitive disturbance, attention, concentration, memory, their grades have fallen. Sometimes they've failed the exam, which is unusual because they're quite bright and smart. So those are sort of the symptoms and signs that we're getting in the interview. Then subsequently we can sort of, and there are what we call rating scales. Unfortunately, we do not have any blood tests and scans, which I'll come to just now. But, you know, the rating scales gives us a clue as well in terms of how severe the condition is, do they meet sort of diagnostic criteria. So, you know, a large part of the diagnosis is based on history and clinical examination based on signs and symptoms, etc. Now, obviously, as medical doctors and medical specialists, there are medical conditions that may mimic this condition. So we have to keep an open mind and say, listen, is there not some medical condition? And one of the commonest would be, you know, has this young person or any person taken any drugs? Is this not a drug-induced problem? So doing a urine drug screen is kind of critical and crucial. Then there can be many other conditions, from hypertension, medication for hypertension, diabetes, thyroid disease, or maybe other mental health conditions like anxiety, panic disorder can mimic that. Then in children, especially those reach adolescence, does this look like, because of the high activity level and they're restless and fidgety and can't concentrate, is this an attention deficit hyperactivity disorder? So your what we call your differential diagnosis is critical, that you need to clarify within yourself that, listen, it is this and not that. So you have to exclude some of the conditions, and more often than not, some of the individuals have been seen by the family practitioner or by a specialist physician. But if not, you know, we are incumbent upon doing blood tests, etc. Doing a scan of the brain is not really indicated unless you have further clues that to do a scan. Or you have to, when I say that, it's a computer scan or the MRI scan. What we don't have is scans which neurochemically show us the brain chemical abnormality. It's not available yet readily. It's done in research laboratories, and we do know that this bipolar condition is a brain chemical disorder. There is an imbalance of brain chemicals. And at a very simple level, in the manic state, you've got too much chemicals, certain chemicals. And in the depressive phase, you've got too little. So that's the imbalance. And therefore, those who have too much, your treatment will involve bringing some of those chemicals down. And what you call, when the chemicals are low in the depressive phase, to increase those low chemicals to eventually get the balance.
All right. Doctor, now we're speaking about the chemical balance within the brain. Can we talk a little bit about the treatment and how the changes that the patient goes through? Does this mean that the medication would have to be changed as the patient goes through, or what medication is available for someone who suffers from bipolar mood disorder?
Well, certainly the medication has to be targeted to the phase they're in. Those who are in the manic phase, okay, they are high, they're restless, they're fidgety, they're not sleeping at all. So we use what we call neuroleptic medication, which is major tranquilizers. These are not your sleeping pills. Okay, these are strong medication, as people may call it, but no, they help to cut down the activity level, to sedate the individual so that they do not get into trouble, because get themselves mentally and physically exhausted, which may then compromise their physical health. The individuals who in the high state have developed a heart attack, because you're on the go all the time and you're 45 years old and you didn't know you had high blood pressure as well, and before you know it, you've got a cardiac incident in a way. So we use what we call sort of one-on-one, you know, the correct terminology is neuroleptic medication, or call it antipsychotic medication or atypical antipsychotic medication. So this high phase, this manic phase, is a psychotic illness, means you have lost contact with reality. You don't know what is happening. You're not aware of what you're doing, and you are a danger to yourself and others. So that's the main medication at that time in the manic phase. In the depressive phase, we use antidepressants, which are the exact opposite in terms of effect. Now, because of the mood swing, that those who are high, sooner or later, are going to go down. And those who are down, we have to be careful that we don't push them up, because our antidepressants, sometimes when they come in the depressive phase, we don't think of bipolar, we think of unipolar, that you're depressed right now and you're only going to be depressed. And lo and behold, you put them on an antidepressant, within 2 weeks, they are sky high. They are all over the place. That gives you a diagnosis in a way. So those two phases, the high phase, the low phase, has its own individual treatment, medication. Then we have medication which we call mood stabilizers. And these are the mainstay of treatment, mainstay of maintenance treatment. Now, years gone by, and still it's coming back in the fall, we had lithium as the treatment medication. Now, lithium is a salt and has been very, very effective, easily effective, but the problem is the side effect profile, and that has led many people to be careful using it. But it's still a very good medication. It's been around, this salt, lithium carbonate, has been around for a long time, 50 years or so. But what has come to the fore is medications that were used for patients with epilepsy. Now, because epilepsy is a cyclical condition, you have an attack and you get better, you have an attack and get better, individuals did research and said, well, epilepsy is electrical activity in the brain, which the medication stabilizes. Can it help stabilize the brain chemicals? And yes, it has been, and it has. So we use anti-epileptic medication, not because a person has got epilepsy, because they've got a mood disorder. And these are mood stabilizers, and that's long-term maintenance treatment. Can go into specific what you call tablets, anticonvulsants that we use, anti-epileptic medication, but I'll just keep it general right now in terms of the families of medication that we use. Sometimes, you know, with the mood stabilizer, you need a neuroleptic medication, you need what you call an antidepressant, sometimes all three families of medication concurrently. So sometimes, you know, patients often complain that my doctor gave me too many medications. Now, yes, some of us have failed to educate the patient in their treatment, because it is very important for the patient themselves to own the illness, that this is what I have, and therefore I need to take the treatment. If you remain in denial and you stop taking your medication after a week or two, you're just going to keep cycling away and getting yourself into serious problems.
All right. Yeah, definitely. I think, Doctor, you've hit the nail on the head there. We just have a question. We have a few minutes left, and the time has actually run away from us, because I've prepared so much to discuss on this topic, but it seems to be quite vast. I'm sure we'll have to schedule another show where we can go into further detail.
I just interrupt you. What you talked about medication. Only, okay. Don't want to just quickly want to say two things, what you call it. We don't forget that these individuals benefit from psychotherapy as well. There's individual therapy. If the person's married, you know, you deal with a couple, you know, from the family as well, educating them, managing the, because the carers themselves go through difficulties, because these are difficult, smart individuals, clever individuals, who, you know, can give you quite a runaround. And family need to be well educated to monitor and ensure the patient is taking the medication. Sorry, go ahead with your questions.
No, definitely. That was an important point. I think the importance of the support system from the family is definitely of great value. Doctor, we have a few minutes left. I just have a question from a listener. The listener requests clarity. It says, did the doctor say that bipolar is hereditary, and in relation is addiction? And I'm assuming they're referring to substance abuse or drug addiction. Is addiction hereditary and genetic in relation to bipolar?
Yes, the question of being, yes, you know, all of them are related genetically in a way. The thing is that it's not, you know, like 100% all genetic. If one individual has this condition and they've got an identical twin, brother or sister, okay, if it was all genetic, then it'll be 100% the other person will get ill. And the answer is no. It's around sort of 35 to 50% likelihood. So what is the other 65%? What is the other 50%? And those are environmental factors, life events, life stresses, etc., to have a major influence on bringing on this condition. Interestingly, when you look at from the genetic side, if you take, let's take bipolar disorder, they tend to sort of breed through. Means if you've got a family member who's got bipolar, the chances are the relative subsequently will also have bipolar. Those who've got unipolar will also sort of breed, let's call it, unipolar condition. And it's not one gene involved, it's what we call polygenic. So there's too many genes involved, and we don't even know all the genes as such. So from a genetic counseling point of view, you know, one can just say, listen, this is the likelihood, this is what it is, and let's observe, though, you know, it's not going to be definite at all. But interestingly, with these mood conditions, these mood disorders, whether it's bipolar, manic depressive illness, or depressive illness only, it shares a number of genes with addictive conditions, substance abuse disorder. So you often get what we call comorbidities, meaning that this person has bipolar disorder or has got depression, but is also abusing alcohol, also abusing drugs. So that compounds the treatment. Okay, and then as an aside, there's also a kind of overlap with sort of criminal behavior. There's a genetic part to that as well to complicate this genetic makeup of these individuals. So therefore, one has to be very careful that these are smart individuals who are impulsive and they can make quite good criminals in a way and quite creative in some of the criminal activities they can get up to. Because again, the genetic loading is there. But quite often, you know, the drug abuse, substance abuse that these individuals get into sort of mimics and presents like bipolar. Like, for instance, which is fairly common in the community in this country, is cocaine use. And cocaine mimics bipolar disorder. Because when you take cocaine, it sends you up. You become high, full of life, full of energy, less sleep, etc. And then within 24, 48 hours, it drops you and you go into a severe depression. And you learn very quickly that to get out of severe depression, you take some more cocaine and you get lifted up again. And that becomes the addiction in a way. And you're chasing now, or you're preventing this low down feeling. So yes, drug, we always keep an open mind about drug abuse, and routinely any patient who gets admitted in our care has a routine drug screen done. Have to exclude that because it compounds the management.
Wonderful answer, doctor. And I think it's definitely important because we're suffering with such a great pandemic in our country, where we have mental health issues, we have bipolar, we also have a high number of individuals who are affected with substance abuse. I feel personally we haven't even scratched the surface when it comes to this topic, and definitely we need to revisit it one day. Unfortunately, we've reached the end of our show. But Dr. Mulla, I just want to thank you from the bottom of your heart. May Allah reward you abundantly for your time and your expertise that you've shared with us. And we will definitely have you back so we can discuss this again. And we jazakallah. Thank you so much for joining
inshallah.
Us.
Shukran, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum.
Walaikum salam. Alhamdulillah, that was a wonderful program, and our sincere thanks and goes out to Dr. Ismail Mulla. May Allah reward you abundantly for that. And definitely it's something that we need to look at. We definitely need to go more deeper into this topic and that relationship between mental health and substance abuse. Yeah, so if there's any questions or any queries that you still have, you're welcome to contact Radio Islam International. They will definitely put you in contact with either the doctor or the Islamic Medical Association so that you can get the information that you require. From myself, Muhammad Ismail, Jazakallah for welcoming me into your homes this evening. And I would like to extend a sincere thank you and Jazakallah to our engineer, also to Sister Zinat from the Islamic Medical Association for making all of this happen. Inshallah, until we speak again, this was signing off on the medical program, and medical program is brought to you by the Islamic Medical Association of South Africa. So if you want to get involved in the Islamic Medical Association, we would definitely welcome any contributions. We have the cataract project that's running, we have the dialysis project that's running, there's also the frail care center which is being built up in KwaZulu-Natal. So definitely get in touch with the Islamic Medical Association. We will definitely welcome any form of support. For myself, Muhammad Ismail, fi amanillah, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.